the week of December 13th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 33, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, already standing in line for the opening night of Avatar, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're not really standing in line, are you?
Really?
No. I'm paying a homeless person to stand in line for me, because that's what we do in New York.
Oh, well, that's very smart of you. Well, we are definitely going to be talking a lot about Avatar on this episode, because it comes out December 18th in just a few days. We're going to have James Rocky on, a freelance entertainment journalist who writes for MSN and works with Dig.com. To talk about Avatar, he was at the premiere in London. We're also going to be talking about some of the year's top 10 lists for movies that have started to come out, as well as some music lists and television lists. I guess this is the time of year for top 10 lists, so we'll go over all of those. We're also going to talk about a top 10 list that a lot of people may not know about, which is the top 10 unproduced screenplays, which is put together by an executive at Universal. And then finally, we're going to wrap up with some big deal or big whoop news and then into Inside Baseball, where we will be talking about the Hollywood Trade publications. But as always, we start off with box office news.
Awesome. Well, it was a big week at the box office. The number one film of the week was the new Disney 2D animated film, The Princess and the Frog, which opened wide with $25 million. Number two was The Blind Side, Sandra Bullock's hit drama, which grossed $15 million and hit $150 million total. Clint Eastwood's Invictus, the rugby-themed film with Nelson Mandela, starring Morgan Freeman and Matt Damon, had a softer opening of $9 million, though Clint Eastwood movies tend to open pretty soft. Twilight Saga New Moon is still chugging along. It made another $8 million. It's at $267 million U.S. A Christmas Carol made $6.8 million. That's at $125 million. It looks like it's going to be done, because Avatar will open up and take away all its 3D screens. So for a movie that costs $200 million, $125 million is not great. Brothers is at number six with $5 million. 2012 keeps chugging along. That's $155 million total. Old Dogs is almost done. It's grossed $4 million. I don't know how. Armored, the heist movie, grossed $3.5 million. It's almost done at $11 million. Ninja Assassin is almost done. That's at $35 million. Also pretty darn good considering the movie and the reviews it got. And George Clooney's Up in the Air went up to 72 screens, and it grossed $2.4 million or $34,000 per screen, which is pretty great. It's at $4 million total. It's starting to pop up on year-end lists, and it's sure to do really well when it goes wide Christmas Day. In smaller release was A Single Man, the Tom Ford film starring Colin Firth. That made $216,000. And box office as a whole is setting a record. It topped $9.7 billion. We're sure to hit $10 billion before the end of the year. That'll be the first time in history. And the Knots look set to, as a whole, box office and attendance will both be higher than the 90s, which is higher than the 80s, which is higher than the 70s. So movies are still a great business.
Although we should say that 2002 remains the modern record for attendance. And it's only this year that it's not only the box office is up, but so is attendance. Because from 2002 to 2008, attendance dropped. And the only reason that there were increases in box office was because of ticket prices.
Yes, but from 2000 to 2009, attendance totals will be higher than in the 90s.
Yes, that is correct.
And that will be higher. So year to year, you can get caught up in whatever, but more people went to the movies in the noughts than in the 90s, which is higher than the 80s, which is higher than the 70s. There's a steady upward growth for box office and attendance, and that doesn't take into account the fact that they're also spending another $10 billion on DVDs. So movies are a great business.
I would be very interested in trying to find out what the per capita is, because, of course, movie attendance is going up, but so is the population. So I'm wondering if a larger or greater percentage of the population is still going to movies, or whether it's the same number, or whether the percentage of the population going to movies has actually declined.
That's fair enough. There's certainly some truth to that, that there's more people. But if you look at, you know, the number of studio films, I mean, there are more movies released as well, but a lot of them just get really modest releases. It's a lot easier to release a small film now, I think, with IFC and Film Forum and these places that will just show a movie. So I think the number of major studio releases has been fairly constant for the last 20, 30, 40 years. The nice thing is people are still going to the movies. I went to see The Princess and the Frog and Invictus, What did you guys see?
Well, I saw The Princess and the Frog, and I can tell you, I saw it with two children who happened to be related to me very closely. And one is 4.5, and my youngest daughter is 3, and they were kind of a little bored. It was not necessarily the best Disney film to come out in a while. There was no plot. There was no emotion. It really seemed like a movie that was going through the paces. What did you think, Michael?
Have you taken the other films or animated films and they've been more engaged?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Toy Story, they were like right there with it the whole time.
Interesting. I thought it was pretty good. It certainly was better than, you know, Meet the Robinsons and Treasure Planet and their last string of 2D animated movies. It's for a non-Pixar film. I think it's their best in a while. It was pretty good. It was never great, but it was never bad to my point of view.
Well, right. I would agree with that. I mean, the music was okay. There were some pretty good songs. The story was, there was really no plot until the third act. Quite frankly, everybody's making a big deal out of the fact that this is Disney's first African-American princess. But 15 minutes into the film, they turn her into a frog.
Well, people say that, but it is a very, very black-centric film. I mean, a lot of the characters are black, both good and bad. It's set in New Orleans. There's soul music and Zydeco and Cajun. There's an old black. I mean, there are black people throughout the film. So it's not like there's one black character and she disappears. I think it is indeed a very black-centric film, and it's notable for that reason.
Well, the other animated film this week was A Christmas Carol, and you said that $125 million. Isn't really great for a movie that costs $200 million, and I'd agree with you. However, I do think this film, A Christmas Carol, will actually be released next year and the year after and the year after that. So this is a film that you're going to see again and again. It's going to be a perennial, much like a Polar Express was. In theaters, yeah.
Yeah, I disagree. I think a Polar Express worked because there were not enough 3D IMAX movies available. And so they were able to do that for a few years. But now there's so many 3D movies that the interest in seeing a 3D IMAX film, which is what I think carried Polar Express for a year or two after it came out, just isn't there. There's so many other movies now. Why would you go see a Polar Express instead of Avatar? No way. I don't think so. What about you, Karen?
What are my thoughts on A Christmas Carol or what did I see this weekend?
Give me both.
I think we kind of can guess what I think of A Christmas Carol. Big snooze.
And you finally saw Up in the Air, right?
I finally saw Up in the Air. I loved it. I really did. It was one of those movies that stayed with me and really makes you think. And I'm so tempted to give a spoiler here, but the way that it ends, I thought was like just the only way it could have ended. And I was not expecting that.
You mean when they blow up the Death Star?
Yeah, the blow up Death Star. But it gives you an interesting perspective about figuring out what you want out of life now instead of waiting to see if, it comes to you.
And it's such an intelligent adult film. I mean, it just feels like it's sexy and it's funny and it's dramatic and stuff, but it's just like an adult film. And I feel like Clooney and Vera Farmiga are such movie stars in the way they sort of seem to mentor Anna Kendrick. It's just very fun.
Oh, there's that one scene after Anna Kendrick, cries in his arms.
We should explain. And, Anna Kendrick plays George Clooney's, I guess, protege in the film.
Yeah.
In a way,
but
yeah.
It's George and Vera, of course I'm on first name basis with them, on one side of the table and Anna Kendrick on the other, and they're like, it's like the parents talking to their child, and it's just
yes,
such a great scene. And I agree. I think Vera is such a star and she never gets credit for anything she does. Not in this, not in The Departed. I mean, people note that she's in it, but she doesn't get the kudos that frankly, I'm surprised that Anna Kendrick is getting, because I didn't think she was that great in it.
I thought Vera Farmiga would be getting all the Best Supporting Actress attention for this movie. But they did both get nominations from some people, so maybe they'll both, or Vera will pull ahead. I thought Anna Kendrick was fine, but I thought Vera Farmiga was great. It's such an interesting role. And we were talking last week about this silly story in the LA Times saying that, the studio was worried the movie was too much of a downer because it dealt with, firing. And we were like, no, that makes it so timely.
It's completely timely.
And in fact, Frank Rich has a column in this week's Sunday Times talking about the movie and how it taps into the zeitgeist. You couldn't ask for it's spreading into other areas of not just beyond the entertainment page.
I guess the big news at the box office this week, besides The Blind Side only dropping 22%, which is pretty good, is The Princess and the Frog was the highest grossing opening ever in December for an animated film.
I find that unbelievable. I guess they released them all in Thanksgiving. That's been the traditional animated movie kickoff.
That's right.
Christmas Day, they don't want to do because kids got to go back to school in a week. So they want those 4 to 6 weeks. Whereas an adult film like Up in the Air or Sherlock Holmes, they don't mind doing it on Christmas Day.
Well, why don't we get James Rocky on the phone to talk about next week's number one movie. Dial him up on Skype here. And hello, James.
Hi, Sperling. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And thank you for joining us. Now, James, you know, I don't know how to introduce you these days. You're on Dig with Peter Jackson. You're flying all the way to London to see the premiere of Avatar. But you are a freelance entertainment journalist who writes for MSN and Cinematical. Are there any other outlets?
Well, Sperling, these days I'm mostly writing for MSN and for Redbox's Red blog, as well as picking up the occasional gig here and there. For example, Dig reached out to me looking for someone to host their Dig Dialogue with Peter Jackson. In short, you know, when people say there are no full-time film critics anymore, there are nonetheless plenty of people who are doing it and making a living.
Now, would you say, reading Ann Thompson's blog this week, I mean, effectively what she's saying is, yeah, they're making a living, but they're not making as good a living as they used to.
Well, frankly, I've only known freelance life for the past 4 years. So, I mean, I really can't compare with somebody who has the institutional memory and history that Anne did.
Yeah, and that's actually a compliment that you're paying her.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you know, most of us, Dr. Jones, are just passing through movie history. But Anne Thompson is movie history. And that's not meant as a snide dismissal. It's the fact that when it comes to people with an institutional track record of amazingly qualified work and seen and done it all.
And now you're seeing and doing it all, especially Avatar. You went all the way to London to see the premiere of probably the most anticipated film of at least the last 5 years.
Yes. I was sent to cover the premiere and the interviews for MSN, and was, in fact, walking down the blue carpet, not red, blue, and had the chance to be at the world premiere of Avatar. And, you know, as we've discussed before, this is under the category of stuff where if it were a 20-minute drive from my home, that would be fine. If I have to go to London to do it, well, I'll take that too. And, frankly, the chance to be at the world premiere of a film, fascinating.
Now, are you allowed to tell us what you think of the movie?
Oh, absolutely. My review will be filed for MSN later this week, but essentially, this is a very good, very big summertime action film that, for reasons of effort and timing, is coming out in the winter. You know, I think that Avatar, like many films these days, faces the sort of superheated atmosphere that the internet creates, where everyone thinks either it has to be amazing or it's going to be horrible. And the boring truth is somewhere in between. No, Avatar is not horrible. No, it is not the future of cinema. It is a very, very good, big action film. And somewhere, Michael Bay is crying because the bar for summertime action has been raised. And that's not as exciting as saying, oh, good heavens, it changed my religious beliefs. Or, James Cameron should never work again. But that reality falls somewhere in the middle. I kept on thinking of, you know, those places in New York that offer a $100 burger on the menu, where it's like, it's a $100 burger with foie gras and shavings of gold and mushrooms from the Napoleonic era. Well, Avatar feels like a $100 burger. It's well made. It's obviously expensive. It tastes great. And at the end of the day, it's a burger.
And title. Avatar is a hamburger.
It's a very, very good burger. Don't get me wrong. It's an extraordinarily well-made burger. But, I mean, the idea that this is somehow a Best Picture contender, there's only one way in which this is a Best Picture contender, and that's if the Academy pulls what I call a gladiator and decides to reward the film about how amazing Hollywood is over the film about actual things going on in the world. If Avatar were to be nominated for Best Picture and win over the best actual movie of the year, The Hurt Locker, it would just be one more reason to burn down the Kodak Theater.
What's the other reason?
Oh, bear in mind that, you know, I was having this conversation this weekend on the bus of a group of entertainment journalists, and, you know, the Oscars are kind of silly. They're kind of silly, and they're kind of useless. And, you know, I get a lot more out of looking through various critics and top 10 lists and going, what didn't I see? Than going, I wonder what movie Ernest Borgnine thinks epitomizes all that is good about movie making.
Ernest Borgnine being an Academy member who votes on all of these categories.
and being the archetypal Academy member who is around 80 to 90 to 120 years old, who is a wealthy white male multimillionaire and who has a kind of political sensibility you get from being in show business your entire life.
You kind of mentioned a couple of top 10 lists, and we're going to get to that in a second, but I just wanted to ask you, you also talked about how, you know, there was this internet frenzy around Avatar, and it really seemed this week that all of the, you know, the Twitterati of entertainment journalists, they just were going on and on and on about Avatar, having seen it mostly in London. I mean, I guess is that where the junket was?
Yes.
I wonder what you thought of the studio embargo. It seems silly for me that they could have a world premiere and expect people to still embargo the review. I mean, once you make a world premiere, obviously you're respecting the embargo. But I mean, once you show it, aren't all bets off in a way?
Well, and the other thing is that after positive reviews started coming in, 20th Century Fox then got rid of the embargo. Embargoes are kind of nonsensical, quite frankly. You know, the movie's out there. It's shown to people. There are modes of distribution. Putting up an embargo suggests you don't want people to talk about it at all, and Variety and Hollywood Reporter don't respect them anyhow. I myself am old-fashioned in that, you know, I tend to think not, you know, if you said to me, you have a choice between reading a review from someone you like and trust versus you have a choice to read the review which is first, I'd tell you which one I'm going to go with. You know, I think that the heedless rush to be out in front of the story is in fact damaging the field.
We should say that what we're talking about here is that movie studios expect critics to wait for the movie's actual release day or a day before to post and publish their reviews. And what The Hollywood Reporter and Variety, two trade publications that we're going to be talking about much later in the episode, they actually forced 20th Century Fox to show them the film early. They showed it when London was seeing it, so Thursday morning here in Los Angeles, and they then posted their reviews immediately, and they kind of broke the embargo, which kind of let the floodgates open. Did 20th Century Fox actually officially release the embargo, James?
Yes.
So they
just said there's no embargo anymore.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go.
How is Sam Worthington in this? Did he live up to the hype from Terminator?
I mean, Sam Worthington, you know, I got to ask him this. I said, you know, you have Terminator 4, you have this, you have Clash of the Titans. Do you intend to just keep playing emotionally vulnerable tough guys until your knees give out? And, you know, he laughed and he said, seems to be working so far, mate. I mean, this guy is a natural movie star. He's really good at it. He shows up. He looks great. He's more than willing to do what big directors require. And he's somebody you can put a movie on. I think that once he has one flop, you know, there's a danger that his heat will appear to be microwaved as opposed to carefully banked, and that could be problematic. But right now, he's easy to watch on screen. And also, I mean, no one's going to hand out acting awards for this movie. No one. Primarily because, like I said, it is very new flesh over very familiar bones.
Well, speaking of awards, there are maybe not awards, but certainly some accolades being handed out by the critics societies all over the nation. The Boston Society of Film Critics selected The Hurt Locker as their top film of the year, as did, I believe, the LA Film Critics.
And the New York Film Critics.
Ah, really?
Yep. Online Film Critics Association emerged from her parents' basements to pick Avatar. But the actual New York Film Critics Circle went with The Hurt Locker. You know, I'm a voting member of LAFCA, Sperling, and also a member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, which has a Hurt Locker among one of their 10 nominees. I think it's interesting that, you know, I can file roughly the same ballot for both organizations, and one of them makes me feel like, you know, the worst kind of elitist, and the other one makes me feel like the worst kind of troglodyte. The LA film critics are smart, and they see everything. And at the same time, you know, broadcast film critics, it tends to be more nationally distributed and less engaged in that end of year concentrated on the coast release pattern, which can benefit a film like A Single Man and hurt people in America who actually want to see it.
Right. I mean, The Hurt Locker is the film directed by Kathryn Bigelow. It was an independent film about a bomb squad in Iraq. And it came out in the summer. And I really thought that it might get forgotten by the time award season rolled around. But indeed, it's actually being remembered. Jeremy Renner, the star of the film, was selected by Boston Society of Film Critics as the best actor. If you look and Kathryn Bigelow was selected best director by LAFCA. It does seem that there are two categories that everybody agrees upon, and that is Best Supporting Actress and Best Supporting Actor. For Best Supporting Actress, everybody agrees that Monique from Precious is the Best Supporting Actress of 2009, and for Best Supporting Actor, it seems to be unanimous that Christoph Waltz from Inglourious Basterds has been selected.
And bear in mind that, you know, those reflect voted on consensuses more than they reflect, you know, I know plenty of people who did not have Waltz or Monique on their ballots or on their radar or in the number one position. You know, I myself would have given it to Vera Famiglia and Peter Capaldi from Up in the Air and In the Loop. But I mean, these are groups and we have to build a consensus of some kind, and something that is seen as strong can often come through, or it's a way of expressing admiration for a film by being firm about it in one category.
Well, Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon, which won Cannes, and Oliver Assayas' Summer Hours seem to be duking it out for Best Foreign Language Film, as do the film Up, the Pixar film Up, and Fantastic Mr. Fox seem to be duking it out for Best Animated Feature in all of these critics' picks.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because right now I sort of was saying to a friend only half jokingly, the best animated picture race is going to be more philosophically interesting than the best picture race. You know, because you have, you know, in that field, you've got everything from the stop motion 3D of Coraline, the old school stop motion of Fantastic Mr. Fox, the primitive stop motion of something like A Town Called Panic, the hand-drawn 90s Disney musical nature of The Princess and the Frog, and the new school Pixar fable of Up. That's a very... And also the sort of bizarre, surrealistic goofiness of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. That's a really interesting group of films.
Right, so what you're saying is some of the best films today are being made on computers.
No, I'm saying that animation of all kinds has had a very good year.
And there's also Miyazaki's Ponyo, which may or may not get on the Oscar list.
Miyazaki's classic hand-drawn squiggly and warm Ponyo. Exactly. I mean, there's more of a spread of technique, you know, you could suggest, than in the Best Picture nominees. And also more foreign films that are being looked at seriously.
Well, and Jeff Bridges for A Crazy Heart seems to be picking up a bunch of accolades. I did not see this film.
That's going to be a career momentum win if it happens. I mean, you know, sort of, you know, everyone was saying, can you believe Jeff Bridges doesn't have an Oscar? Which is not the same thing as you can't believe how much Jeff Bridges deserves an Oscar for this film.
Right. And The Cove seems to be picking up a number of best documentary, I don't want to say prizes because they're really not prizes.
The best thing about all of these top 10 lists and all of these critics lists is that hopefully they'll shine a light on underseen films, and movies like The Cove and Seraphine and Summer Hours will really benefit, especially on DVD, where that kind of attention can make a difference. I always say that if you want to get one interesting thing out of the Oscars, all you have to do is watch the 10 screenplay nominees from every given year, as that's usually a much more interesting bunch of films than whatever winds up actually winning.
Ah, very interesting you should bring up screenplays, because this past week on Friday, The Blacklist was released and sent out, and it was sent out by Franklin Leonard. I invited him to come on and talk about it, but I guess he's gotten so much attention for it that he has decided not to speak to the press at all and do any interviews. He's an executive over at Universal who puts together every year a list of the top 10 unproduced screenplays, and he was very nice and explained why he didn't want to talk to anybody, because if he did, he would probably not have time to do his day job. But this year, the top unproduced screenplay is actually about Jim Henson, Christopher Weeks' screenplay, The Muppet Man, which is about the life and loves of Jim Henson. And it's kind of it's a fictionalized biopic because he didn't know Jim Henson, and he didn't do any research. He did very little research.
And again, I mean, if you look at Michael Lewis's great book about Sesame Street, Henson was not an uncomplicated cat. He was a very strong businessman. He was very much in favor of creators' rights. Also, any movie is better if you can put Muppets in it. Almost every film. Martin Scorsese, if he had just put a Muppet in Gangs of New York, would have gotten that Oscar for Best Picture. I am, of course, kidding, but really, this sounds like a great 1-2 punch. And while a lot of the time I dislike showbiz biopics as being a little too self-congratulatory, I just, you know, yes, we're all aware there's no business like show business. Henson is such a fascinating figure. I really hope this makes it happen. The other thing is that there's a bunch of screenplays on the blacklist, which weirdly are already in production. Everything from Due Date to The Social Network to Buried, which is also in production and quite done. I think, the thing about blacklist needs, it's like when you go to Sundance and you see a very bad film and you think, well, what didn't get to play here because of that? When I look at the blacklist and I see a film that's already in production, like Buried or Due Date or The Social Network on it, I can't help but think, what screenwriter that isn't able to sell their piece yet, that's looking for a deal, wasn't able to get on the list, as opposed to that film, which already has a deal and already is in production.
Right, and The Social Network, we should say, is Aaron Sorkin's screenplay, and it's about Facebook, and that's in production right now.
Yes. Due Date with Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis in production now. Buried, coming out very soon with, is that Chris Evans? Is it Ryan Reynolds? Which good-looking hunk of man meets in Buried again? I forget.
Man meets?
I have no idea. I think it's Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, it's some good-looking young actor who'll do quite well at it.
Here's something that I find actually very interesting, is that there are produced screenplays on the blacklist. Is this just Franklin Leonard being lazy, not bothering to take them off once they've been produced, or?
No, I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to invite him on, because I wanted to ask him, you know, what qualifies a film as being unproduced, because certainly The Social Network is technically being produced. And Buried is being produced, although I don't see Buried on this list.
Buried is at number 18.
Oh, okay. I was only talking about the top 10 list. Do you have the list?
I'm looking at the full list. But, I mean, and down on the list are, you know, Due Date and Buried. But, I mean, looking at the top 10, obviously this is something where it'll get interest going in these projects. And if it makes any of them happen, terrific. I'm sure we'll hear the news of these films being announced in between Disney saying, we would like to make G-Force 2.
And it should be noted, to your point, James, and I guess answering your question, Karen, as to whether Franklin Leonard was being lazy, I don't think he is. In 2005, the list contained both Diablo Cody's script for Juno and Nancy Oliver's script for Lars and the Real Girl. Both were nominated for Academy Awards last year, and of course, Juno, was it last year or 2 years ago? Juno
yeah,
won.
Yeah, but at the time that they were on the list, were these screenplays unproduced?
They were unproduced, yes.
Right.
Well, then there
it's
you
the
go.
The whole point of the list.
I don't think that The Social Network needs to have any kind of push, you know, just to make sure people know it exists. I think most people know it exists. If it was being produced, it doesn't belong on this list.
Franklin Leonard is doing a bad job of a volunteer effort he puts together.
Exactly.
Franklin Leonard's individual perspective, which already has a completely distorting effect upon Hollywood, is not being adequately performed.
Well said, well said.
Literally, I think my brain there was a short circuit. I have absolutely no idea what you just said.
I'm just saying that, you know, this is the blacklist for all of the talk about it and all of the buzz about it. It is the work of one human.
Although he does actually talk to 400 different professionals in the motion picture industry, and they vote on it.
And in that way, it's sort of the equivalent of a critics group. I mean, I find the blacklist fascinating and flawed in equal measure. It's much like the Miss America pageant. All the philosophical problems I have with it don't take away from the fact that it's plenty of fun to watch.
I'm with Karen a little bit, because if I'm going to make a list of the best movies of 2009, I shouldn't include Juno. you know, just make sure that if your list is about what it is, it's included. But I wonder if you think these screenplays, some of them will get made because he put them on his list. Do you think more good movies will get made now that Paramount has opened a division that will make micro-budget movies of less than $100,000? I guess they were excited by Paranormal Activity, which cost $15,000 and grossed more than $100 million in the U.S. But, James, do you think Paramount should be dealing in movies that are budgeted less than $100,000? Is that a game they should be playing?
You know, it's one thing to be struck by lightning, and it's another thing to put a galvanized metal bucket on your head and run around a hillside in a thunderstorm to try to make it happen twice. Paranormal Activity was a hit, not because it cost $10,000. It was a hit because it was good. Obviously, everyone in Hollywood would like to try and make more with less. You know, the advent of digital cinema makes that possible. The thing is, there are plenty of bad micro-budget movies. Just because a movie has a micro-budget doesn't necessarily mean it's any good. At the same time, The Messenger could not have cost a lot, and that's a truly amazing film. So Paramount saying we are going to found a division to make under $100,000 films, well, that's all well and good. Just make sure they're good movies to begin with. Anytime you reduce the causal idea to a formula like that, it becomes a bit dicey and a bit tricky.
Well, Adam Goodman, the head of Paramount, is saying, and this is a quote from John Horn's piece in the Los Angeles Times, "I feel very strongly we need to be contrary in our thinking. Everybody has the ability to create content right now." And Horn points out is not all of these micro-budgeted movies will be released theatrically. Some of them may very well end up acting as calling cards for first-time filmmakers or novice directors. They might wind up being workshopped, essentially, inside the studio where, you know, a screenplay is developed. Maybe the film is never shot.
Right. They'll spend $100,000 and put the film on a shelf because it's no good.
Yeah. Should this be something an intern is doing or the assistants can do in their spare time?
You mean develop $100,000 movies?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem what a major film studio is good at. You know,
why would you need a whole division for it?
NBC is not good at creating, you know, quick little podcasts. They're good at creating hour-long dramas and sitcoms geared towards a mass audience. I don't think Paramount is going to be very good or interesting at picking scripts and things that will work at the $100,000 level. It's something indies can and should do.
I mean, the thing is that, I mean, if you said, well, Paramount's restarting their indie division after they shuttered Paramount Vantage, that might be interesting. But the whole idea of saying we're going to make under $100,000 movies, that just seems a little cynical and a little bit backwards. You know, a movie should cost what a movie costs. Saying we have a division that's only going to look at sub $100,000 movies, A, ignores the fact that a $100,000 movie can be as good as anything else Paramount's putting out, and B, that a under $100,000 movie can be as bad as anything Paramount's put out.
Well, of course, this routine has been tried before. Fox Atomic was a division that was geared toward genre films, and 20th Century Fox closed that recently. As you mentioned, Paramount Vantage was shut down, I believe, just last year. Universal had Rogue Pictures. It no longer has Rogue Pictures. So it's very odd, the herd mentality that everybody participates in. Now that this $15,000 film has made $100 million, everybody's, you know, racing off to try and make 20 $100,000 movies in 1 year.
Right, which is why I'm glad to announce production on my shot on video in my home horror film, Werewolf in My Wardrobe.
This reminds me of George Lucas, who announced a few years ago in his brilliant insight into Hollywood that studios should stop making big budget movies, that they'd be much smarter to make 200 movies that cost $1 million rather than one movie that cost $200 million, ignoring the fact that that's what his entire career was built on. And if you're a studio head, I'd rather have Avatar than the next 100 movies that Paramount makes for $100,000.
Well, I mean, George Clinton said it best when he was talking about Prince and Michael Jackson. He said, you know, you can understand how the label would rather have one person selling 20 million records than 20 people selling 1 million records or 1 million people selling 20 records. It's just an economy of scale and ease. You open up one movie that makes $200 to $400 million, everybody gets a new car and some champagne. You open up 200 movies that make $10 million profit, you're still in the black, but you're going to be spending a lot more late nights at the office.
Well, James, I really appreciate it, and I think I can speak for Karen and Michael here. We really appreciate you coming on to talk about Avatar and all of the movie news this week. I know you've got to run and you're on deadline, but I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Sperling, Michael, Karen, very much a pleasure as ever. And yeah, if you're looking for all of my far-flung work, you can find it at www.rockyreport, R-O-C-C-H-I, report.com.
And you can also be found on Twitter. At James Rocky is the username to look up.
Exactly, Sperling. More importantly, my greatest of thanks to the three of you and everyone out there in Radioland. Happy and safe holidays, however you celebrate.
Thank you very much, James.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was nice to have James Rocky on talking to us about Avatar.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't realize that the junket for Avatar was in London, although it makes sense. I thought it was just the premiere, and I thought, God, all these journalists flying all the way to London just to see a premiere. I mean, especially when they're having a premiere here in Los Angeles and they're doing one in New York. I thought that was a little extreme.
In the winter, brr.
Yeah, well, with the junket being there, I completely understand it.
Well, let's move on to TV. Sperling, can we move on to TV?
Absolutely, we can. No, I would like to point out, though, in all these top 10 lists that were mentioned, I forgot to mention that Samson and Delilah, a very interesting Australian film that I saw in Cannes, and I don't know, Michael, did you see it?
I urged all of you guys to see it. Don't you remember? I was pounding the drum for that movie.
That's right. It won 3 Australian Film Institute Awards, and it won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Writer. It is a great film, worth seeing, and I'm a little surprised that it's not making people's lists here in the States.
Well, it wasn't released. It wasn't released in America yet.
Oh,
it hasn't come out.
Well, that was
just like a prophet. A prophet doesn't come out till February.
So TV. Yes. Let's move on to TV, and we will kind of pick up where we left off on Hiatus or Back Nine.
Yeah. I don't remember what date we actually did that.
Oh, it was episode 22.
Okay.
I have a rundown of what happened to all these things. So you can tell us what we said and I can tell you whether we were right or not. If we're not sure.
So we're talking here, Karen, about the article you highlighted in the LA Times, which goes over network TV's winners and losers.
And I'm a total sucker for these lists. And on it as winners are ABC sitcom Modern Family, which is Michael and my new favorite show, CBS's NCIS Los Angeles, Fox's animated The Cleveland Show, let's see, CBS's The Good Wife, yay. Fox's Glee, of course, and CW's The Vampire Diaries are all winners. And among the new series that have already tanked are Eastwick, no surprise there, Hank, not much of a surprise there, and NBC's medical drama Trauma, no surprise there. Oh, and Dollhouse, which just got canceled as well.
I'm surprised they have V as a winner because that looks a little soft to me.
Well, I think it's only been out for, 4 episodes or something. I think it's a little soon to be judging it.
Yeah.
But before we go into saying whether we were right or wrong, I do want to highlight 4 things that this article in the LA Times pointed out as some lessons to learn. Scheduling still matters. And they used as an example moving house to Mondays, where it's gotten a lot of viewership there. In fact, I stay home almost every Monday because I need to watch House in real time. Comedy is back, sort of. And they gave an example of Modern Family and The Cleveland Show for that. But it's still sort of in shaky ground because, like, The Middle, for example, is not doing all that great. But still, comedy seems to be making a comeback. Viewers love them some crime procedurals, no surprise there. And that Leno in primetime was a bad idea.
That seems to be, like, the big television news this year, period.
And I love it.
Well, now let's talk about what you and Michael thought of some of this season's shows and whether you thought they would be put on hiatus, meaning canceled, or they would be picked up. And that's, of course, the Back Nine. The Good Wife on CBS, the hour-long drama, both of you thought that it would be picked up Back Nine, and you were both right. Accidentally on Purpose, also on CBS. Michael, you thought it would be put on hiatus. Karen, you thought the Back Nine would be picked up. And
It's actually Back Four, I believe.
Yeah, it's gotten 5 more episodes, so it's up to 18. And they haven't quite done a full season, but they're certainly showing a little confidence in it. So Karen is more right than I am.
Three Rivers, also on CBS, a medical drama. Hiatus, you both agreed. And
yep.
Yep.
You were right.
NCIS Los Angeles, probably the season's highest rated show. You both thought back nine, and I don't even have to ask whether you were right. You were right. Cougar Town, the half-hour sitcom starring Courtney Cox. You both thought back nine, and
you were right.
Flash Forward, ABC. You both thought back nine, and
you were right.
That's, of course, the hour-long kind of supernatural drama.
Sci-fi, whatever, yeah.
Modern Family, of course, as you mentioned, Karen, both of you thought it was going to be back nine, but as you mentioned, Karen, it's a huge hit, and so you were right. It was picked up for the back nine. Eastwick, the witches ABC show, I don't even know what that show was about, but you both thought it would be...
It was about the witches of Eastwick, and even when it was casting, you knew it was never going to last.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't last. It was put on hiatus. As both of you,
I'm sure they pitched it as Desperate Housewives with magic.
Well, totally. It wasn't more desperate than Housewives. Hank, starring Kelsey Grammer, you both thought it would be put on hiatus. This was the half-hour sitcom on ABC. You were right; it was canceled.
Yep.
The Forgotten,
brilliant,
on ABC. You both thought it would be put on hiatus.
We were wrong.
You were wrong.
We were wrong.
Ooh,
it's picked up for like back four, back five.
Five. So they're up to 18 episodes. It certainly hasn't done well, though.
This is the one with Christian Slater where he finds...
Oh, that's right.
He finds people have been forgotten, but I forget why they've been forgotten.
Yeah, because they've been murdered and they can't...
Yeah,
it's like Cold Case. Shark Tank. This was the reality show.
No, we skipped the middle. We both said hiatus. We were wrong.
Yes, the middle was a sitcom half hour on ABC. You both said hiatus. You were wrong. Shark Tank, half an hour, or was it an hour long kind of reality show for entrepreneurs? You both said hiatus and?
Right.
We were wrong and right. Well, it was put on, it was pulled, but it's coming back. But I think they're just burning off episodes.
Ah, okay. The Cleveland Show, the animated spinoff of The Family Guy. You both said back nine. It's a huge hit.
You're back nine.
Yes. Brothers.
I say it's the biggest hit of the season because unlike NCI Los Angeles, it's really lifting up both The Simpsons before it and the shows after it. It's the most unexpected hit. I think it's really revitalized that Fox sitcom lineup, which was a little old. And it's really, I think it came out of nowhere to be a success. So I think that's the biggest surprise success story of the fall.
Well, also a success is Glee. You both thought it would be picked up for the back nine. You were right. Brothers.
Not doing great, though. It's more of a critics hit than a commercial hit. It's doing fine, but it's not exactly tearing the house on fire.
But they're not going to cancel it either.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Brothers is also on Fox. You both said it would be put on hiatus, and the verdict is?
Hiatus after like one episode.
Okay.
Maybe two.
Melrose Place on the CW network. You both said back nine and...
We were right, but...
Was it for the full nine?
I think it's got the full season, but it almost certainly won't be back. It's been a pretty
much
it'll
be
a disaster.
The last one.
It would have been canceled if they had more of a network, but they have nothing to put in its place, so they have no choice. But it probably won't be back next year.
Vampire Diaries, also on the CW. You both said back nine, and?
We were right.
A hit. The only hit they have.
Community on NBC. You both said back nine, and?
We were right.
Back nine.
Okay. Mercy on NBC, which is, I guess, a nurse's medical procedural. You both said hiatus, and the answer is?
Back nine. We were both wrong.
We were wrong.
Wow.
I love this show. I'm so happy it's coming back.
Wow. Okay. So Trauma on NBC, also a medical procedural. Apparently, they have a bunch of doctors working for them. Or, actually, it's owned by GE. NBC is the network owned by GE. They make a lot of medical supplies. Interesting.
It's not owned by GE much longer.
Well, yeah. Now, we said this before the show had even premiered. Michael, you said it was going to be back nine. Karen, you said it was going to be hiatus. And I believe it's hiatus.
Karen was right. No. Karen was right. It's hiatus.
Well, I read something about a show that is premiering in January. It's called Conveyor Belt of Love. It's going to be on ABC, and this is the trailer for this show.
These five single women, all looking for love, are about to be introduced to 30 single men. will be delivered one at a time on a conveyor belt.
Oh.
Hey, ladies, do you love to laugh?
Yes.
Each man will have 60 seconds to charm the women.
Hello, ladies.
In whichever way he chooses.
Kindness, how you do it.
And the women will decide whether they are interested.
Been contributing to my 401k since I was about 18.
I'm interested.
Or not interested.
I prefer to date in the cougar bracket that's over 32.
I'm kind of a fireball, too.
Count with me. Are you ready? One, two, three.
Oh, my God.
If two or more of the girls are interested in the same guy, the power shifts, and he gets to decide who to date.
Is it my turn to pick?
I found him first.
And when the belt stops, we'll follow our women and their partners on their dates. Who will find love and who won't?
Okay, well.
Oh my God, a cougar is 32 or above? That really scares me.
That sounds like something you see late night TV, you know, one of the Love Connection or one of those, you know, dating game shows.
It's speed dating. It's sort of horrifying, I suppose, as a TV show, but it's hell, it would be the great way to date, frankly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, because you usually know within the first like 5 seconds, right?
Right. I predicted in the first episode, one guy will come out on the conveyor belt and just take off his shirt.
Totally.
Yeah.
And whip down his pants. That'll be the next guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I, for one, am watching this show.
only a Guido would watch a show like that.
I was just going to say, are you watching Jersey Shore? Yeah, segue alert, by the way. Are you watching Jersey Shore? I had no idea this show was even on television until I was on Twitter a week ago and Jersey Shore was a trending topic. And I thought, wait a second, I'm from Jersey? What the heck? Why is Jersey Shore a trending topic? It turns out it's a TV show.
This sounds horrific. No, I have not seen it.
I've seen clips of it on Talk Soup.
This is a show where they stick a whole bunch of, I guess, Jersey people, Jerseyites, into a summer beach house on the Jersey Shore in Seaside Heights. And I guess it portrays people from New Jersey as being somewhat... I don't know, missing a few brain cells, and the Italian-American community is very upset because they say it does not portray them in a good light. It says, the reality show depicts everything they say a summer in the Garden State is about. Hair gel, hookups, and the coveted flawless tan. I can tell you, having come
That's what any summer beach house is about.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where it's set.
It's just, I got an email a few days ago or a week ago or whatever from like the New Jersey Commission decrying the show. And I just thought, why bring attention to it? Why, you know, what do you think you're going to accomplish by sending out an email saying, we think this show unfairly depicts Jersey? You know, I mean, for God's sake.
I'd say embrace the show. You're going to get more people coming. It's good for commerce.
Yeah, I have to say, though, I guess it's the ratings are up 50% because one of the contestants or one of the cast members gets punched in the face in the second episode and they decided to cut that.
Sweet.
But the story on this, it's an MTV show, we should say.
Is it up 50% compared to what was in the time slot previously or compared to the pilot episode, or what are you talking about?
I don't know. I just read that it was up 50%. I don't care.
You can't trust ABC News to tell you the accurate things. You got to read what they're saying.
Oh, I was reading that, I think, on... I don't know where I was reading that. What I love is in the story... this is a quote, so I'm reading this story from ABC News. As another cast member, Paulie D, readies to move to the house in Seaside Heights, New Jersey, where the show was filmed earlier this year, the cameras capture him filling an entire suitcase with hair gel. Hair gel, he says, is all part of the Guido lifestyle. It takes me about 25 minutes to do my hair, you know what I'm saying? That's what he says.
I know guys who are not of Italian descent who put hair gel in their hair.
Hey, there's no way I'm going to Jersey without my gel. That's the end of the quote.
My God, listen to you.
Hey, I'm from Jersey.
I had no idea you were from Jersey.
Yeah.
I didn't either.
Me and, you know, my neighbor Bruce. Springsteen.
Let's let's move on.
Okay, let's get off of television then, and we can go right into, I guess, music. Yeah.
You know, along with all the lists of the best albums of the year and the best albums of this and that, we also had the best albums, best-selling albums of the decade. And number one was the Beatles, who, with their compilation Number One, which is all their number one singles, sold 11.4 million copies. Number two was NSYNC with No Strings Attached, 11 million. Norah Jones, Come Away With Me, 10 million. Eminem had two albums, the Marshall Mathers LP and the Eminem Show, 10 million and 9 million. Usher with 9 million. Linkin Park, Creed, Britney Spears, Nelly. All of these albums sold between 8 and 11.5 million copies. And what I found fascinating.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, this is fascinating. All of these albums were released in 2004 or earlier. Right, not a single album from 2005 on has hit the top 10. I think the record is the highest selling album 2005 on is Josh Groban's Noel, which sold 5+ million copies. I mean, that's really telling about where the record industry has gone.
Seven of the top 10 albums of the noughts, as you call them, Michael, were released in 2000.
Yeah.
So that really does tell you something. That's before Napster really took hold, or the Napsterization of music really took hold, and people got broadband connections to start downloading their BitTorrents.
And thanks to those two LPs, Eminem is the best-selling artist of the decade. He sold 32.2 million albums, while the Beatles were number two with 30 million, which makes me very happy because I love the Beatles. Moving on, the top songs of the year, God help us all. Black Eyed Peas with Boom Boom Pow, according to Billboard magazine, is the number one best-selling and played song of the year. Lady Gaga was at number two and three with Poker Face and Just Dance. Black Eyed Peas again at number four with I Got a Feeling. Taylor Swift with Love Story. Flo Rida with Right Round. Jason Mraz with I'm Yours. Beyonce with Single Ladies. Kanye West with Heartless. And All American Rejects with Gives You Hell. Those are the top songs of the year.
I'll tell you, that Lady Gaga, she's, you know, both two and three, she's really quite popular. I'm going to have to BitTorrent some of her music.
Nice.
Hang on, I'm going to call the FBI. I saw her on Barbara Walters' 10 Most Fascinating People. Mm-hmm. She reminds me so much of Madonna 20 years ago.
Well, wasn't she on Saturday Night Live with Madonna?
Yeah.
Kind of like catfighting who was like the bigger...
But it,
like...
it was a joke. I mean...
Okay, yeah.
She's actually... Yeah. Lady Gaga is a lot smarter, I think, than she's given credit for.
She's interesting. She does a lot in the art world, and she seems really... I like her and her take on stuff more than necessarily her music, but I think she's interesting.
I think her music's really fun, actually. I mean,
yeah.
It's workout music.
Yeah. I made fun of Billboard a week or two ago when their coverage of the Grammy nominations, because they were so slow off the base, and they have their charts out of the top songs and the top albums of the year. Their top album of the year list doesn't even list how many albums they sold. You know, I had to go elsewhere to find out, you know, this sold 3.4 million copies. It's like, it's Billboard. How can you not have that on your list? It was a very complicated chart with, you know, a video embedded in it and all this stuff. And what I wanted was the darn, you know, amount of copies they sold.
Billboard needs to hire you, Michael.
Well, maybe they will now that they've been sold. And we will be talking about that in just a bit during our Inside Baseball segment. But first, of course, our very popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop? We have a couple of entertainment news stories to talk about this week, and we will determine whether people should be paying attention to them or whether they should just ignore them. The first one is Flight of the Conchords is grounded. Zaptuit is reporting that Jermaine and Brett and Jermaine, I believe their names are, deciding not to do a third season of Flight of the Conchords, which airs on HBO. The show is hilarious, and I always wondered how it was that Brett and Jermaine were able to actually write all of the songs for that show, because they write these comedic songs that are plot-driven, and it just seems like it would be a lot of work, and I think they're kind of admitting, yeah, it's a lot of work, we're not going to do it anymore. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm confused. Are you saying that they called an end to the show, or that HBO canceled it?
No, they called an end to it.
Well, that's and HBO wanted to make more episodes.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Why didn't they just take a year or two off? That's fascinating. I'd say that's a big deal to walk away from a show on HBO. I'd say that's a big deal.
Karen?
I agree. It's a big deal.
Moving on to the Academy Awards, sort of. Some Academy screenings of Invictus and Nine were rained out on Saturday, and effectively what this means is that Academy members who live here in Los Angeles and were headed to Beverly Hills, and it was raining pretty bad on Saturday, were not able to see these films, so these films, their Oscar campaigns are going to have to step it up a bit. I guess the power went out at the Academy headquarters, so they couldn't screen the films. The LA Times was saying that these are two films that are big Oscar contenders and now a huge audience because I think it's 12 to 1300 people can fit in the Samuel Goldwyn Theater. Couldn't see the film. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I suppose it's a big whoop, but I don't think Nine, for one, has any hope of winning any Oscars.
Michael?
It's a big whoop for us. Neither of these movies are Oscar contenders. They're not appearing on any lists. But it is funny how something like this can affect your campaign. You know, suddenly, not only did they go up there to see the movies, but it rained and they made them wait hours before they left. That just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And any chance you have certainly gets soured by something like that. So it can definitely have an effect on your Oscar campaign.
What can also be a big deal for your marketing campaign is the rating for your movie. And our next story is about It's Complicated, that wonderful movie starring Mel Streep that we keep talking about. Apparently, the MPAA, quote-unquote, saddled the film with an R rating thanks to a scene in which the main characters, who are in their 50s, I should point out, are smoking marijuana. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
This is a big deal in the sense that it's unbelievably ridiculous. A, marijuana is legal in any number of states now. You know, possession of less than an ounce of marijuana is not even a misdemeanor in a number of states, like Alaska. It's medical marijuana use is legal. Maybe Steve Martin has glaucoma, but it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. As they point out, you know, you can slaughter millions of people. But, you know, if you smoke marijuana, which is legal in a number of states and much of the world, you know, they're going to give you an R rating. That's absolutely absurd. It's also, from what I read somewhere, I don't know where, but it's one of the funniest scenes in the movie with Steve Martin and Meryl Streep getting stoned. So I'm not surprised they didn't cut it.
Well, right. And it's one of, I think, six scenes that Steve Martin appears in. So Universal did not want to cut it, which was the only way they could have gotten a PG-13 rating. And part of the problem was, the MPAA said that there were no bad things that happened to the characters because they smoked marijuana. So, yeah.
It's like something from the 30s. It's so ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and the story points out that 2012 and Terminator Salvation can show rampant violence and the deaths of literally billions of human beings and still earn themselves an all-important PG-13 rating. I think it's a big deal because at the end of the day, a rated R film has you know, the marketing is curtailed because you can only advertise it in certain places and at certain times. So that might be a problem. The reality is nobody under the age of 17 is probably going to see this movie anyway. So its core audience is old.
Steve Martin has a big family following. Don't forget the Pink Panther movies, Cheaper by the Dozen.
Good point.
He's made
a
lot of family films.
Yeah. And he's in six scenes.
And Alec Baldwin's on 30 Rock on TV every week.
I think this is a big deal. On a few levels. First of all, it's totally ridiculous because I think that it's a very, very good point that, you know, people can be slaughtered and still get, you know, a G rating. But I also think that it speaks to the fact that marijuana should be legalized, which is entirely different to me.
Well, sticking with movies for just a moment, Sigourney Weaver.
I noticed Sperling, you didn't comment when we both said that marijuana should be legalized.
I am busy rolling something right now and can't.
Maybe Steve Martin has glaucoma. That'd be a totally different movie.
Moving on and sticking with movies, Sigourney Weaver, while walking up the blue carpet, was talking to Channel 4 in the UK, and she said, "I'm afraid to say it, Ghostbusters 3 is happening. I hope people are excited about that. I don't know if I'm going to be in it. I've had a couple of calls asking, would you read the script? I know that my little son Oscar, who was kidnapped from me, I think he has grown up to be a Ghostbuster. I might be in it. I see nothing wrong with being in it, although I don't think I will have a big part. I think Bill Murray has a little more to do with it. He's a ghost." So she's kind of announcing that Ghostbusters 3 is happening. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
I hated Ghostbusters 1 and 2, so to me it's big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal as far as, you know, Ghostbusters was one of the biggest comedy, special effects comedies of all time, if not the biggest. So, and number two was so bad, it'd be nice for me to get it right, but it's a long past its due date. But Bill Murray as a ghost is a good idea.
Well, what about Al Pacino as Shylock? Here's a little theater news for you, Michael. Al Pacino is going to star in The Merchant of Venice in Central Park next June. He's kind of sticking with theater for a while. He's 69 years old, and he will play the role of the Jewish moneylender, as he did in the 2004 movie directed by Michael Radford. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You have to get in line now to see the show. You know, anytime he's a, you know, exceptional stage actor, so it's not just like a movie star walking through a play. You know, Shakespeare in the Park can be very popular. Meryl Streep has been in it the last few years, and it was just a madhouse to get a ticket. So it's going to be crazy.
So you're saying a ticket to Merchant of Venice next June in Central Park is a good holiday gift?
I would give a pound of flesh to get it.
Wow. Okay. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Let me wake up from my nap. Hang on.
Wow. Apparently you can take the pound of flesh from Karen. Meanwhile, we'll be discussing our inside baseball topic for this week, which is about the Hollywood trade papers. First off, and we can get this out of the way right away, Daily Variety, which does not have a new owner, does have a new editor. It turns out the job once held by Peter Part is going to be held by Leo Walensky, formerly of the Los Angeles Times. He was an editor there. He started actually in the news division or the news department, but he then went on to culture and arts. Variety, the circulation has fallen to less than 25,000 from a high of 35,000 in 2001, and they are planning on putting up a paywall starting soon, actually. So Variety will not be free anymore.
Good, because, I mean, well, bad for me, because I don't want to pay for Variety. But, you know, why should people pay, what, $200 for a year subscription to the print Variety and yet get online Variety for free?
I agree.
I've always thought that seems really strange.
I think they should, I think they should have a dual wall where they have basic things like reviews and stuff that appeal to the general public, but like the charts and their schedule and the movies that are in production, that should be behind the paywall. I think they're going to regret it. I think it's a good opportunity for The Hollywood Reporter to step in and stay free and get all the audience that might have gone to Variety. They can't link to it anymore. They'll link to The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, speaking of The Hollywood Reporter, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago that a group that included Lachlan Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's son, was interested in buying the Nielsen Media family of industry trade publications, and they actually did. However, Lachlan Murdoch, who had been seeking to join Team Finkelstein, which I guess the Finkelstein group purchased the assets, he pulled out. He did not stick around.
And he bought, prior to this decision, bought 50% of an Australian radio company instead, which cannot be a good buy. That seems very strange to me.
Radio is in better shape than print magazines, that's for sure.
Yes. Well, you know, Lachlan Murdoch is trying to start his own little media empire, and I guess they're seeing it as a statement of you know, the future of print, that he doesn't want to be involved in it.
Yeah.
I wonder if this new group will have any influence over Billboard so that Michael can actually start reading it again.
You know, Michael, what you said about radio being a better bet than print, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but in buying all these, the Hollywood Reporter and Billboard, I mean, they bought the online versions too. And even though people aren't necessarily going to destination sites anymore, those I think are worth something.
It will be very interesting to see what happens to the Hollywood Reporter with their new owners. Certainly, mm-hmm. Roger Friedman is now over there. Steve Zaitchek is no longer there. He is over at the Los Angeles Times. So I'm very interested to see what happens to the Hollywood Reporter because, as I've stated here before, this is a trade publication that, rumor had it, would be discontinued. At least the print version would be discontinued early next year, and it would go online only. So now all bets are off. I'm very interested to see how this plays
out. Well, I think it makes sense that it goes online with a paywall, but it makes sense. There's just no reason to print the Daily Hollywood. Maybe just the one weekly issue, but not the Daily. The Daily Variety and Daily Hollywood Reporter is just a complete waste of print. You know,
I totally agree. It should be unavailable in print. Everybody should have to read it online.
And I think you should all get your entertainment news from us here at Showbiz Sandbox, because in under an hour, you can find out everything that's happening in entertainment. If you want to subscribe to our show, you can do so on iTunes. We are also setting up a Zune store. Now, if you want to find links to any of the stories we talked about on today's episode, you can do so by visiting our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can look them up in the show notes for episode 33. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter and Facebook. We are now, by the way, Karen, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
We got our URL?
We got our URL, which apparently you only need 25 fans for, and I did not know that. So,
oh, that's new.
Feel free to visit our website and follow us on any of our social networking accounts. If you want to email us, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us. The number is toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode is by MGMT, the popular...
Grammy-nominated MGMT.
The Grammy-nominated MGMT. You can find more information and more music from them on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen can be found at karenwoodwardonline.com, as well as on Twitter, kwoody3939.
Oh, no, I changed it. You didn't notice that?
I did not notice that.
I'm now Karen_Woodward, like a proper little professional.
I will have to change all of my Twitter followings.
Okay. No, you don't have to. I didn't start a new account. I just changed my name.
You can do that?
Yeah.
On Twitter?
Sure.
Huh. Well, Michael, you're also on Twitter. Michael Giltz, no underscore, is the name to look up. You can also look up michaelgiltz.com to find links to all of Michael's work on the Huffington Post, the New York Daily News, The Advocate. Everywhere Michael writes, he will place a link on his website. As for myself, I am on Twitter as well. @Sperling is the name to look up. You can find my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.